Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
Wer die Finanzen eines Unternehmens managt, ist oft beschäftigt. Sehr beschäftigt. Sehr, sehr, sehr beschäftigt. Konto ist das All-in-One-Geschäftskonto, um Ihr Unternehmen zu managen. Egal, ob Sie selbstständig sind oder die Finanzabteilung eines mittleren Unternehmens leiten. Mit Konto erledigen Sie alles in einer App. Geschäftskonto schnell eröffnet? Erledigt. Ausgabenmanagement? Erledigt. Buchhaltung und Reporting? Erledigt. Konto. Das Geschäftskonto, das zu Ihnen passt.
Sommer, Sonne, sowas von besonders. Jetzt die coolen Mercedes-Benz Sommerhits entdecken. Über 4000 attraktive Vorführ- und Geschäftswagen aus unserem Bestand. Von A-Klasse bis V-Klasse, von Cabriolet bis SUV. Alle kurzfristig verfügbar, alle zu Top-Konditionen, alle für Sie bereit. Sommer, Sonne, Sommerhits. Nur bei Ihrer Mercedes-Benz-Niederlassung vor Ort.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. We're coming to you live from London. My name's Paul Henley. Last night's televised US election debate, the first of the campaign between Joe Biden and Donald Trump, was always likely to be pivotal. But such was the performance of the 81-year-old incumbent president that the overwhelming reaction comes today in the form of a question. Is it time to find another Democratic candidate? And many Democrats are the ones asking it. The 90-minute exchange was bad-tempered, personal, and marked by Mr. Trump making a stream of easily debunked claims, but it was on Mr. Biden's faltering presentation and his inability to bring vigour and stamina to the debate that most attention fell. Well, concern among Democrats was clear straight after the debate. Speaking to MSNBC, the former Democratic Senator, Claire McCaskill, who was meant to be cheerleading for the president, said many in the party felt it was a moment of crisis.
Joe Biden had one thing he had to do tonight, and he didn't do it. And that was reassure America that he was up to the job at his age. My phone blowing up with senators and campaign operatives, big donors from all over the country. There is more than hand-wringing tonight. I do think people feel like that we are confronting a crisis.
So, in the wake of this debate, can the Democrats really afford to stick with the status quo? And if there were to be a change of candidate, what would need to happen? Dr. Thomas Gift is Associate Professor of Political Science and Director of the Centre on US Politics at University College London. He joins me live from Pennsylvania now. Dr. Gift, is there an official process to remove a candidate?
Well, it's great to be with you. Thanks so much for having me. There is a process that is determined by Democratic Party rules, but it's so unprecedented that we haven't seen it unfold before. So really, there are two options for replacing Biden. One is for another candidate to throw his or her hat into the ring as part of an open nominating process. And the second is for Biden to bow out voluntarily and for other candidates to compete for the nomination at the convention. Option one is virtually impossible to imagine. Biden has accreted roughly 95% of so-called pledged Democratic delegates during the primaries. Pledged delegates aren't legally bound to support Biden, but a widespread revolt is almost implausible because many of these individuals are longtime Biden loyalists. Option two, which is much more likely, is where Biden declines to accept the nomination. That would essentially create a free-for-all at the convention. Pledged delegates would no longer remain committed to him, and we could see any number of potential candidates vie for their support.
But if Mr. Biden did choose to vacate office, surely the presidency would, the default, would fall to Vice President Kamala Harris.
Well, that's what it would occur in terms of who would control the White House. So she would be the new president. But if we're just talking about the election in 2024, then all bets are off. It really could be anyone.
And who, I'm not going to ask you for a list of names now, but it would take somebody to step forward first, would it, even if the president resigned?
That's right. I mean, I think that there are a few individuals who would be at the top of that list. One is California Governor Gavin Newsom. Another is Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer. And then, of course, Vice President Kamala Harris. The problem is that Kamala Harris has approval numbers that are even lower than Joe Biden. And also those two other names that I mentioned, they haven't been sort of vetted on a national scene. And so it could inject a lot of risk for Democrats to go a different direction than Biden.
Is there a deadline for a change of candidate?
All of this would have to happen at the convention, which is later this summer. So there's not a rush for Biden to make a decision one way or the other. In fact, I think we're unlikely to see him come out soon and say, I'm not running. I think the campaign and the White House wants to let the dust settle, see how surrogates are feeling in the next week or two, and then reflect on that process and what's best both for him as well as the Democratic Party.
Doesn't some individual state law make it clear that the candidates have to be declared before August?
So for the primaries that are occurring, almost all of those delegates have actually been accrued by President Biden. But there's really no law that's governing this. It's really just the parties. And so the party official nomination occurs in the summer. That's where any candidate actually becomes officially the nominee. So it wouldn't have to be done until then.
Dr. Thomas Gift from the he's professor of political science at the Center on on US politics at University College London. We'll be talking to a Republican strategist later on in the program, but let's hear live now from Jamie Harrison, who is chair of the Democratic National Committee. Welcome, Jamie. What went well?
Thank you. Well, listen, it was a slow start, but a very strong finish. And in the end of the day, you know, people are going to make a decision in this election based on who is better for their lives and their families. And in that debate last night, what we heard was a lot of lies from Donald Trump. But he was focused on himself, not on working families across this country. So on the issues that people care about, President Biden spoke to families, what they're going through and what he will do about it. Donald Trump didn't have any plan or any vision for moving forward. He had a bunch of lies. And so we have to understand that, you know, presidencies aren't defined by 90-minute debates, but by the time in which they're in office and the policies that they move forward. And Joe Biden has a strong, strong portfolio of things that he has accomplished and that he's done for the American people and that he will continue to do so when he gets four more years.
But something shifted last night. The Democrat strategist's argument was always that Joe Biden was uniquely placed to fend off a threat to democracy from Donald Trump because he'd managed to beat him once before. What if he no longer is uniquely placed? What is plan B?
Well, listen, again, if you look at the history, most incumbent presidents, that first debate is always a little rocky, knocking off the cobwebs. I am assured. I've been with Joe Biden all over this country for the last 4 years or so. And I can tell you, this man knows what he's doing and he's been doing it effectively. And so he will continue to do it. He's going to be our nominee and we will move forward and we will win in November.
A little rocky is the kindest that I've heard anyone put it so far. You've got to manage not just wider critics, but a massive wave of criticism from your own party now. I'll quote a little bit of it. Andrew Yang was a Democratic candidate in 2020. He says Mr. Biden was a different man to debate then. He thinks he's lost it. He's partly responsible for hashtag swap Joe out that's been trending on X since the middle of the debate.
Well, Andrew Yang is not a Democrat. So what he says has as much value to me as what Donald Trump says.
The point is, there's a national and international conversation going on now of which you're no longer in control, and it's that Joe Biden demonstrated that he wasn't suitable for the job.
No, the point is that Donald Trump showed how dangerous he is, not only for America, but for the rest of the world. I'm sure you heard his conversations as President Biden pushed him on what he would allow Vladimir Putin to do in Ukraine. That should send nightmares to not only Americans, but people across the world. And so folks need to really focus on that. Again, you know, whether or not you are strong or whatever in a debate is that's one point. The question is your vision. The question is your leadership. Donald Trump showed last night that he's a very, very dangerous man that is just focus on payback, retribution, and revenge, and he cozies up with some of the most dangerous people on this planet. That's a nightmare for not only America, but for the entire world.
But the focus now is not on whether Donald Trump is a nightmare and a danger for the whole world. It's on, like it or not, it's on Joe Biden's performance. And if you don't change candidate, aren't you missing out on a massive opportunity to build a powerful cross-party coalition? Republicans like Steve Schmidt, a strategist opposed to Mr. Trump, put it fairly kindly, fairly gently, Mr. Biden needs to step down in an act of humanity and selflessness now. He was talking about saving the world, too.
Stop the hand-wringing, start rolling up your sleeves and do the work. And that's what we have to do. You know, my grandfather taught me early on, he said, nothing in this world good comes easy. And so this election is going to be tough. We always knew it was going to be. And last night didn't change that. So we got to roll up our sleeves, do the work. We know we got a good man, an honest man, a decent man in Joe Biden who has done a masterful job over these last few years and will continue to do so.
Who's talking to Mr. Biden right now? Are you?
Well, you know, listen, I'll see the president tonight as we go and we have an event with the LGBTQ community where, you know, he will hear from folks. And he will put out how he has fought for this community over the last 4 years. The reason why that folks in the LGBTQ community can go to sleep resting, knowing that, you know, their marriages will be secure is because Joe Biden led the effort to make sure that the Marriage Equality Act was passed into law. Never before had that been done, but Joe Biden got it done. So, you know, that's the type of leadership that he's had over the last few years, and that's the type of leadership that he will take.
And despite of that,
forward.
Despite that, there are many Democrats today asking if it's wise to be surrounding the president with people telling him everything's fine. Is that the case?
Well, listen, the president has been doing this work for a long time. He understands whether or not what he did well last night and what he didn't do well. But ultimately, again, a presidency is not defined by 90 minutes on television. A presidency is defined by the work that you do. That's why you go to the polls to elect a president, to get stuff done. And you can't tell me that there's been a president in my lifetime, I know, that has gotten more done with less than Joe Biden. I mean, he has delivered time and time again, and he will continue to deliver moving forward.
And he will appear at the next planned TV debate?
I'm sure he will. Yeah, Joe Biden does not run away from a fight. Never has, never will.
Jamie Harrison, many thanks. Chair of the National Democratic Committee. You're listening to the BBC World Service. This is NewsHour. Coming up, we speak to Academy Award winner Russell Crowe on his way of performing at Glastonbury Festival and why music is his first love.
Well, it's more like a reset for me, man, because this is how I started. And I've been making feature films for 35 years now, but music predated the movies by a long, long way, you know.
The news headlines this hour. The US Democrats are discussing whether Joe Biden can continue as the party's presidential candidate in the wake of his halting display in a televised election debate with Donald Trump. Parliament in Argentina has approved President Javier Milei's economic reform program after months of debate and demonstrations. And Iranians are voting to elect a new president to replace Ebrahim Raisi, who was killed last month in a helicopter crash. More on that very soon. I'm Paul Henley with NewsHour, live from the BBC. Now, France is about to hold the first round of an unexpected parliamentary election this weekend, with the far right widely predicted to take first place. The French president has warned that support for extreme parties, as he called them, on the right and on the left, threatens to plunge the country into civil war. To gauge the public mood, our correspondent Andrew Harding has been to Brittany, long considered to be one of the most politically moderate corners of France.
The weather is finally gorgeous here, and the beaches of southern Brittany are filling up. The Olympics are round the corner. Surely a languid French summer beckons. Or does it? In the pretty market town of Auray, tempers are strained. Political polarisation has finally arrived in rural, famously moderate Brittany. Solène and Alain run a market stall, but when two young men walk past, campaigning for the hard-right National Rally Party, the couple seethe.
Alain, viens, viens dire ce que tu penses du Front National.
C'est le fascisme, quoi. C'est tout. Après, soit bien chaud, un chaud.
It's fascism, says Alain. I call a spade a spade.
On les déteste. On les hait.
We hate their ideas, says Solène. We hate everything about them.
Un peu de jeunesse, les élections législatives.
Ça marche.
Bonne journée.
Bonne journée, monsieur.
One of the National Rally campaigners is a 19-year-old student, Mathis Auger. He thinks mass immigration is ruining France.
Une crise identitaire, excusez-moi, c'est...
We have an identity crisis. The foreigners keep apart. They shop in their own markets. They don't speak our language. They don't assimilate.
Ils ont leur propre épicerie, leur propre marché. Ce sont des gens qui ne veulent pas s'assimiler.
Donc vous avez le sens que c'est plus votre pays.
So you feel you're losing your country, I ask?
J'ai l'impression qu'il change, oui.
I feel that I no longer have my rightful place as a Frenchman, that I'm being forced to change, not others.
Opinion polls here suggest that message, amplified by the media, is cutting through and that the hard right is poised to come first this weekend in the first round of parliamentary elections, even here in sleepy Brittany. We have a history, a culture, says Armand, a retired fireman. And you fear you're losing it, I ask? I'm worried, he says. On the television here, a succession of increasingly shrill debates between French political camps. The left has quickly united against the hard right. But stranded between them, the centre is wobbly and shrinking. And almost everyone here seems to blame President Emmanuel Macron for that. Listen to one of his presumably now ex-allies.
C'est le président de la République qui a tué la majorité présidentielle.
A former prime minister saying Macron just killed his own majority by calling this unnecessary election. I've come along the coast now to Lorient, a big port city. Basketball practice for a group of children in a poor and overwhelmingly immigrant community. You can see the effort that's gone into helping people integrate here, with some success. But for how much longer?
You get a really clear sense of the kind of shock that this election is causing in neighbourhoods like this. Just round the corner at a place called the Maison pour tous, the House for All. It's a local organisation, publicly funded, that helps particularly young people. And the people who run this place have taken a decision openly now to campaign against the National Rally. They're that concerned that this far-right party poses a direct challenge to the fundamental values of the French state.
Je m'appelle Maxime, je suis directeur de la Maison pour tous, qui est un centre social à Kervenanec, à Lorient.
Maxime Godefroy runs the organization.
On ne dit jamais aux gens pour qui voter. Là, on s'est permis de dire que... Voilà, de
we never tell people who to vote for, he says to me. But this time, we've taken the liberty of saying that from our point of view, people should not vote for the National Rally, because it's dangerous. Dangerous or not, the polls now show this city, which used to lean communist, has now swerved towards the hard right. Watching the world go by from a nearby cafe is Saïd, a pensioner, originally from Algeria. The National Rally is dangerous, he says. My wife wears the veil, but they want to ban it, so she's afraid.
Catastrophic.
If they get into power, it will be catastrophic. Back at the beach, a few bathers are braving Brittany's chilly waters. What happens in the next few weeks here is unclear. It could be political deadlock. It could be a hard right landslide, a violent reaction, constitutional upheavals. An anxious summer awaits.
That was Andrew Harding reporting from Brittany in Western Atlantic Coast, France. Now, joining us live from the city of Lille in the north of France is the BBC's Rob Young. presenter of Newsday here on the World Service. Rob, what's the mood like in Lille compared to what we've just been hearing about in Brittany?
It's very similar to, as you heard there in Andrew Harding's report, actually, even though we are on the other side of the country here in northeast France. In certain areas, it is quite tense. There's a market here in a district of Lille called Oisem. It's a working-class district in the old city centre with a reasonably large migrant population. And on market day yesterday, the three main political blocs were out campaigning, handing out leaflets ahead of the first round of the election on Sunday, and it got pretty heated. One man got in the face of the candidate from the far-right anti-immigrant national rally saying, "You are a racist." Somebody else started shouting in French about the benefits of migrants who come to France to work. Yet even in this outwardly hostile market, people who were willing to say to us that they were going to vote for that party. They believe that the current system isn't working economically. They blame migration for what they regard as high levels of crime, and they say that something needs to be done about the numbers of people coming to France.
Post-industrial areas like Lille, not the city itself, but the area surrounding it, tend to be a good hunting ground for far-right votes, don't they?
They do, and traditionally, though, this area, particularly when it was in its industrial heyday, was very much heartland of the political left. And indeed, yesterday we saw an anti-far-right rally led by some of the trade unions here. But in recent years, the proportion of people voting for the far-right national rally has grown and grown. And now if you look at the political map of this north region of France in the northeast of the country, it is increasingly the colour blue of the national rally party. And people are less shy, less ashamed, as some would regard it, of saying publicly they are going to vote for Marine Le Pen's party, although some people do still appear to be reluctant to say so. But in this part of the country, the expectation among that party, the National Rally, is that they will do incredibly well here.
And just remind us of the timetable for these parliamentary elections. It could get a bit complicated, couldn't it?
It could, and the opinion polling that we have at the moment doesn't necessarily allow us to directly translate that into the number of seats that each party would get in the National Assembly. The first round is on Sunday. Then there is a second round a week after that. More complicated by the fact that the schools break up then, and an awful lot of people have already got pre-booked summer holidays, which means they won't be able to go to their polling station to cast their vote. And then so we should know in 9-10 days' time who, if there is a majority of any of the parties, will be able to form the next French government.
Rob Young in Lille in the north of France. Many thanks. This is the BBC World Service. We're live from London. NewsHour.
Sommer, Sonne, sowas von besonders. Jetzt die coolen Mercedes-Benz Sommerhits entdecken. Über 4000 attraktive Vorführ- und Geschäftswagen aus unserem Bestand. Von A-Klasse bis V-Klasse, von Cabriolet bis SUV. Alle kurzfristig verfügbar, alle zu Top-Konditionen, alle für Sie bereit. Sommer, Sonne, Sommerhits. Nur bei Ihrer Mercedes-Benz-Niederlassung vor Ort.
Wer die Finanzen eines Unternehmens managt, ist oft beschäftigt. Sehr beschäftigt. Sehr, sehr, sehr beschäftigt. Konto ist das All-in-One-Geschäftskonto, um Ihr Unternehmen zu managen. Egal, ob Sie selbstständig sind oder die Finanzabteilung eines mittleren Unternehmens leiten. Mit Konto erledigen Sie alles in einer App. Geschäftskonto schnell eröffnet? Erledigt. Ausgabenmanagement? Erledigt. Buchhaltung und Reporting? Erledigt. Konto. Das Geschäftskonto, das zu Ihnen passt.
Following what turned out to be a fairly momentous presidential debate on US television last night, the Republicans have perhaps had an easier ride than some had predicted. With almost all the attention on Joe Biden's performance, the content of some of Donald Trump's arguments has been under less fierce scrutiny. The polls have consistently shown Mr. Trump leading in key swing states, but overall, the race has been pretty much neck and neck. Republicans are hoping, of course, that last night was the moment that changed things. Shortly before we came on air, I talked to Mark Lotter, who is former Director of Strategic Communications for the Trump-Pence 2020 campaign. He's now with the America First Policy Institute, a Republican think tank. He was there in Atlanta for the debate, and I asked him first what the feeling was in the immediate aftermath.
The feeling that was just permeating through the spin room was just the horror from Democrats at what they were watching on stage. This was such an epic, historic collapse of a president, or presidential candidate, and a president on this debate stage. And it was just a one-sided affair that the American people saw for Donald Trump.
Many commentators will say that President Biden spoke largely the truth and President Trump spoke largely untruths.
I would think that'd be selective thinking. I mean, you obviously had you had President Biden up there saying that no troops have died on his watch, but he forgot the 13 Americans who were killed in his botched withdrawal from Afghanistan. So, you know, there are certain partisans who will take, their own side on that. But what they can't say and what they can't argue was Donald Trump showed strength.
Donald Trump very robustly claimed that his administration had the best environmental numbers. He pulled out of the Paris Accord. He rolled back the Clean Water Act. He eased regulations on coal, oil and gas. But he was more convincing in his claims. Is that what it was about?
Well, it is. And all of those things are also true. We saw the amount of pollution drop in the water, in the air, in the land, and we didn't need the Paris Climate Accords, which unfairly punished the United States and United States workers, while India, China, and Russia were allowed to continue to pollute for decades to come. And so he's not wrong in those things. But what people are looking for is strength.
If Democrats did now bring in a different, younger candidate, I appreciate it's a big if, would Donald Trump be in trouble?
No, because I don't think the facts on the ground change. The Democrats and the radicals control the Democrat Party right now. They want this high inflation. They want open borders. And they want to continue to fund the war in Ukraine while abandoning our ally in Israel and telling them try to stand down. But the fact of the matter is that Democrats are stuck with Joe Biden. If you look at all of the recent polling, it shows Donald Trump getting about double to triple the amount of black support that he had in 2020. If they replaced Joe Biden with anyone other than the first female woman of color vice president, well, they're going to lose even more black support because it's just a sheer sign of disrespect. And Kamala Harris is even more unfavorable than Joe Biden is.
The facts of the matter are that you would love the Democrats to be stuck with Joe Biden.
Well, I think the reality, the politics of it are that they're stuck with Joe Biden. But they also really no one can change this except for Joe Biden. It is up to him. The way these convention rules and delegates work, those folks in those primaries are committed to him. And so unless he changes, which I see no indication that he's willing to do so, they're stuck with him. And then after that, it would be an open convention if it happened. I don't think it will. And then what do you do?
We saw Donald Trump ask his supporters publicly before this debate whether he should be aggressive or nice. Do you regret that he chose aggressive, especially given the performance of Joe Biden?
Oh, I thought he was actually very restrained. I thought he obviously corrected the misstatements from Joe Biden and the lies and the debunked things that Joe Biden kept falling upon, which have now been proven in many cases to be untrue. So I think it was a very measured response from President Trump. And that was a problem with the debate format that Biden insisted on, is that with those muted mics, he couldn't even interject. And there was no one there to save Joe Biden from himself.
That was Mark Lotter, Chief Communications Officer for the America First Policy Institute, a Republican think tank. Well, it's true that the American media, all colors of it, seem united in the view that President Biden had a bad night. The New York Times' headline, Biden struggles as Trump blusters in contentious debate. Wall Street Journal, Democrats discuss replacing Biden on presidential ticket. The New York Post, Democratic disaster. Straight after the debate, here was the reaction of the major U.S. TV networks, beginning with Sean Hannity on Fox.
He was so conversant on every issue and he was so well versed and none of it rehearsed. There was a lot of talk. He barely prepared for this debate and nothing fazed him. Some people thought he would react to Joe or the moderators. He didn't react to anything.
First presidential debate of the 2024 election cycle at a very unusual time with very unusual format. And I think with probably strange results. I mean, we'll see the response from both sides. But if you're the Biden campaign, I think you wish that this night will be remembered in reverse as the president became sort of stronger over the course of the night.
The panic level, particularly among elected Democrats who have to share the ballot with him, there's a full-on panic tonight. Maybe they'll get calmed down in the morning, but there's going to be there's a lot of chatter among donors tonight. Again, if the Biden campaign needs to, they have a lot of calming calls that they're going to have to start making, or they may see this get momentum publicly, and I don't know if they can stop that.
Chuck Todd from NBC ending that sequence. He also heard from Rachel Maddow on MSNBC. Well, the BBC's John Sudworth is in Washington, D.C. He joins us live. John, welcome. Chuck Todd talked about momentum building against President Biden. Is that the sense you've got this morning?
Well, not if you listen to those in the administration, of course. Kamala Harris was on the US networks immediately after the debate saying that, look, it had been a weak start from Joe Biden. But ultimately, Americans want substance over style. They want record over rhetoric. But, you know, in the end, the debate was about presentation. These things are always about more than just record. In a television, multimedia, internet age, it matters. And the president needs not just to be a great policymaker, but he needs to be a good communicator. And you read out some of the newspaper headlines there, Paul. I mean, I think what's even more interesting is if you dig into the opinion pages. Look at the New York Times this morning, a bastion of liberal opinion, no friend, of course, to Donald Trump. And the headlines are just stunning. You know, Thomas Friedman, President Biden must bow out of the race. Paul Krugman, the best president of my adult life, needs to withdraw. You've got Nicholas Kristof, President Biden, it's time to drop out. And in a sort of general opinion piece with a number of writers rating Biden's performance, it's accompanied by the headline, God help us.
The president's timetable is relentless. He still has to prove some vigour. He's heading to an event marking the Stonewall riots and attending a ball tonight.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think there's no doubt this is a moment. It's being seen as such. Incumbents often struggle in the first presidential debate. Some people are making comparisons to other presidencies in the past. But the sense of shock and the sense of this rising panic within the governing party, I think, is new. Undoubtedly, as I said, you will see the senior members of the administration putting a positive spin on this. But that discussion, the conversation, has absolutely now been pushed out into the open. The big question, Paul, is whether anything can change, if indeed that is where the Democrat Party finds itself. Because ultimately, the truth is, Joe Biden is the winner of the Democratic primary contests. He owns those delegates. And for something significant to move, it almost certainly would need him to go voluntarily.
Okay.
And, you know, as some of your commentators have said already, there's very little sign that he wants to do that.
John Sudworth in Washington, many thanks. Millions of Iranians are voting in presidential elections today to choose a replacement for Ebrahim Raisi, the man who was killed in a helicopter crash last month. Their choice of candidates is far from free. All four of them have been carefully vetted by Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. But one of them does have some limited credentials as a reformer. There'll be a second round of votes next week if no one man gets more than 50% of the vote. At a news conference after casting his vote, Ayatollah Khamenei had this to say. Election day is a time of great joy and excitement for us Iranians, the Ayatollah said. The longevity, stability, reputation and honour of the Islamic Republic depends on the people's participation. So the call is for a high turnout, but how much difference can voters actually make? Sanam Vakil is director of the Middle East and North Africa program at the Chatham House think tank here in London. She's also lecturer at Johns Hopkins University.
Well, it's meant to give off the impression that this is a free and fair election. In reality, Iranian elections are not completely free and fair. There is an institution known as the Guardian Council that vets candidates before. And this time round, the Guardian Council allowed 6 people out of over 80 to run. And from there, the public is meant to go out and vote. The problem is that obviously the Iranian public is educated and informed, and they have seen Iran's past presidents as not being particularly effective or able to really change the direction of Iranian domestic or foreign policy.
Let's talk about one candidate, though, who has been approved, who has criticized Iran's morality police. Who is he? What's he said?
So the Guardian Council approved the candidacy of an institutionalized reformist, someone who's loyal to the system but believes in reform, and his name is Masoud Pezeshkian. He's served in government in the past, and the system perhaps sees him as someone that can maybe galvanize the public to come out and vote. And in order to be appealing, and perhaps because this is what he believes, he has questioned Iran's sort of stricter and imposing veiling requirements. He is perhaps a more liberal proponent of social reform and suggested that perhaps he might take a different tack in negotiations with the West in order to improve Iran's economy.
That was Sanam Vakil of the Chatham House think tank in London. You're with the BBC World Service. This is NewsHour. I'm Paul Henley with NewsHour live from the BBC. Now, allies of President Biden are struggling to contain the fallout from his faltering, unfocused performance in the first televised US presidential election debate with Donald Trump. At times, Mr. Biden, who is 81, had difficulty in completing his sentences. Publicly and privately, Democratic Party supporters have been discussing whether they should change their candidate before the party convention in 6 weeks' time. Jamie Harrison, chair of the Democratic National Committee, told this program earlier that President Joe Biden was still the best man for the job.
Stop the hand-wringing, start rolling up your sleeves and do the work. And that's what we have to do. You know, my grandfather taught me early on, he said, nothing in this world good comes easy. And so this election is going to be tough. We always knew it was going to be. And last night didn't change that. So we got to roll up our sleeves, do the work. We know we got a good man, an honest man, a decent man in Joe Biden. The president has been doing this work for a long time. He understands whether or not what he did well last night and what he didn't do well. But ultimately, again, a presidency is not defined by 90 minutes on television. A presidency is defined by the work that you do. That's why you go to the polls to elect a president, to get stuff done. And you can't tell me that there's been a president in my lifetime, I know, that has gotten more done with less than Joe Biden.
Jamie Harrison there, chair of the U.S. Democratic National Committee. This is NewsHour. Now, before he was an actor, let alone an Oscar-winning one, Russell Crowe was in a band that did regular gigs in pubs and clubs and had a recording contract. At the age of 60, Russell Crowe's career has sort of come full circle, except that the venue for his band's latest gig is one of the biggest and most celebrated in the world, Glastonbury Festival, here in the UK. So the actor who's most famous for his roles in the massive hit films Gladiator, A Beautiful Mind and Les Miserables has returned to music. He has released a new album called Pros and Cons. His band is called indoor garden party. They play Glastonbury this Saturday. And I talked to him while he was en route to this country, about to take off from Rome Airport. He explained first how the Glastonbury plan came about.
We were on the road last year for about 30 shows or whatever, and we knew we were coming back to Italy to do some shows. So I talked to Simon Moran, who's a promoter, and he did the shows the last time we played in the UK. When I talked to him about it, he said, look, funnily enough, came up in conversation the other night that they were going to ask you to play at Glastonbury. It was pretty exciting news. And then we had to sit on that information for about 7 months. We weren't allowed to discuss it or tell anybody because they do their own announcements. So that was kind of torturous. But yeah, it's really exciting. Everybody in the band's really looking forward to it.
And what can people expect at Glastonbury? How would you describe your music?
Well, you know, it's available to listen to if you're interested. It's called Pros and Cons, and the set at Glastonbury is going to be pretty much made up of the new album stuff because we only play for an hour. But, you know, we sort of touch into gospel, we touch into blues, we do the occasional dirty country song about murder. The majority of what we do is original material, but the thing about the album, Pros and Cons, P-R-O-S-E and Cons, there's 9 original tracks and 5 covers, so the pros being the originals and the cons being the covers.
And is being on stage and performing music a welcome break from acting? Is it harder? How does it compare?
Well, it's more like a reset for me, man, because this is how I started, you know, like 45 years ago, whatever, this is what I used to do. I used to do with the band. I've been making feature films for 35 years now, but I've always kept my connection to music and always periodically recorded and released stuff or to it. So it's a very natural place for me, man. That's what some people find hard to understand, you know, that music predated the movies by a long, long way, you know. My first record came out in 82, and I made my first movie in 89. So, you know, there's a sort of almost a full career prior to me becoming a film actor, so to speak.
A film set's a very strict setting, isn't it? Not like being on stage.
No, you have disciplines on a film set that you have to adhere to, and obviously there's a lot of discipline involved in being on tour for 36 shows or something over a couple of months as well. But yeah, for sure, that's the reason I get a buzz out of it, man, because the very first thing I did when I, you know, set out on a creative journey was walk on a stage and sing a song. And so it's, as I said, it's just a very natural place for me to be on stage talking about the things that are on my mind.
But is it acting, or is it just being you?
With the music, it's 100% just doing me. I'm not playing any kind of role. You asked before about work. I mean, it's an extreme amount of work when you're on a tour like this. I mean, we're only, like, in the first week of it, and already we're just, you know, everybody's starting to drag their heels a little bit because of the travel and the, you know, lining up for things and what have you. But that's what I get to express when I'm on a stage, you know, because there's a certain sense of anarchy. You never know, no matter what you're prepared or whatever, you walk out on a stage, your audience responds a certain way. You might adjust the show around that. You know, the night's always has its moments and its differences.
What about the baggage associated with being you, with being the big movie star?
1 or 2 songs into the set, that just disappears and the whole thing changes. We do get a fair amount of ambulance chases, you know, at our gigs, people that come along and go, well, what's this all about? But, you know, you also got to keep in mind that I've been doing it for such a long time and the music's been available on the internet for such a long time that there are people that have been following everything I've done musically, so they know every word of every song. So it's definitely a combination of people in the crowd.
Even the cover of your album is your work, isn't it? Just describe it.
Well, it's a photograph of a bloke who was thinking about going for a swim in Woolloomooloo Bay in the middle of winter in Sydney. And it was quite cold that morning. And he was just stopped there and had a think. And so I took a photograph from behind him. But the way the light was refracting off the water, it's very painterly and beautiful. It just seemed to me to fit with the idea of pros and cons. I know we're using it as a play on words to do with the content of the songs. But, you know, in the normal usage of that phrase, pros and cons, I mean, he's very definitely contemplating what's ahead of him and the temperature of the water.
And he was up for being on the album cover. He gave you his permission, didn't he?
Yeah, it took me about 6 months to see him again, man. So I was getting a bit worried about it because I thought I've definitely got to have at least one conversation with the guy. And then I was on my balcony in Sydney. I've been away, but I just caught up with him. You know, I ran around the other side of the bay and had a little chat, and he was quite chuffed at the thought of being on an album cover. So, and I showed him the shot, and he really loved it too, so it was cool.
Russell Crowe talking to me inbound to Glastonbury. This is him singing with his band Let Your Light Shine. Thanks for listening to this edition of NewsHour. Bye. Let your light shine. Let your light shine.
Let your light shine.
Sommer, Sonne, sowas von besonders. Jetzt die coolen Mercedes-Benz Sommerhits entdecken. Über 4000 attraktive Vorführ- und Geschäftswagen aus unserem Bestand. Von A-Klasse bis V-Klasse, von Cabriolet bis SUV. Alle kurzfristig verfügbar, alle zu Top-Konditionen, alle für Sie bereit. Sommer, Sonne, Sommerhits. Nur bei Ihrer Mercedes-Benz-Niederlassung vor Ort.